The first reading this morning is from The Spirit Catches You and You Fall Down by Anne Fadiman, which is her account of the clash between traditional and Western culture in contemporary America. Specifically, what happened to a young Hmong girl in California's Central Valley. As an infant, Leah Lee was diagnosed with severe epilepsy. Only to the Hmong, her symptoms showed signs that she had the makings of a shaman, that is, a holy woman. Fadiman's book highlights the trials as two groups, both wanting the best for a lovely young girl, miss each other again and again. This selection is comprised of excerpts from the book's preface. Fadiman writes,
"Under my desk, I keep a large carton of cassette tapes. Even though they have all been transcribed, I still like to listen to them from time to time. Some of them are quiet and easily understood. They are filled with the voices of American doctors, interrupted only occasionally by the clink of a coffee cup or the beep of a pager. The rest of the tapes, more than half of them, are very noisy. They are filled with the voices of the Lees, a family of Hmong refugees from Laos who came to the United States in 1980. Against a background of babies crying, children playing, doors slamming, dishes clattering, and an air conditioner wheezing, I can hear the mother's voice, by turns breathy, nasal, gargly, or hum-like, as it slides up and down the Hmong language's 8 tones. I sat on the Lee's red folding chair for the first time in May 1988. Earlier that spring, I had come to Merced, California, where they lived, because I had heard that there were some strange misunderstandings going on at the county hospital between its Hmong patients and its medical staff. One doctor called them collisions, which made it sound like two different kinds of people had rammed into each other head on. As it turned out, the encounters were messy, but rarely frontal. Both sides were wounded, but neither side seemed to know what had hit it or how to avoid another crash. 9 years ago, that was all theory. After I heard about the Lee's daughter, Leah, whose case had occasioned some of the worst strife the Merced Hospital had ever seen, and after I got to know her and her doctors and how hard it was to lay the blame at anyone's door, though God knows I tried, I stopped parsing the situation in such linear terms, which meant that without intending to, I started to think a little less like an American and a little more like a Hmong. Now and then, when I play the tapes late at night, I imagine what they would sound like if I could somehow splice them together so the voices of the Hmong and the voices of the American doctors could be heard on a single tape, speaking a common language."
By the way, some of you may have seen this word Hmong written out before. It's H-M-O-N-G, but the H is silent. So if you look up that culture from Laos, that's how you would look it up, beginning with an H. The second reading is from Kwame Anthony Appiah's truly wise book, Cosmopolitanism, written 3 years ago. Dr. Appiah is a gift from the country of Ghana to the social understanding of the world. The subtitle of his book is Ethics in a World of Strangers.
What makes conversations across boundaries worthwhile isn't that we're likely to come to a reasoned agreement about values. I don't say that we can't change minds, but the reasons we exchange in our conversations will seldom do much to persuade others who do not share our fundamental evaluative judgments already. When we offer judgments, after all, it's rarely because we have applied well-thought-out principles to a set of facts and deduced an error. Our efforts to justify what we have done or what we plan to do are typically made up after the event, rationalizations of what we have decided to do intuitively. And a great deal of what we intuitively take to be right, we take to be right just because it is what we are used to.
The word cosmopolitan is, oddly enough, one of the oldest words that we use in English, even though it's a thoroughly Greek word. My favorite Greek philosopher, the hilarious and wise Diogenes of Sinope, apparently coined the word cosmopolitan 2,400 years ago. Someone asked him about his hometown. Where do you come from? He answered that he was a cosmopolites in Greek. That is, I am a citizen of the world. And that word that he coined on the spot survived until now, even though we use different letters to spell it, even though it sounds just a tad different. Today, in English, the word cosmopolitan means something like sophisticated or worldly. But because of everything else we know about the very sassy Diogenes, and since he coined a new word using exactly those words, citizen of the world, I'm convinced that when he said it, it meant something like this. I'm not a citizen of any particular city or state. All of our national and political boundaries are somewhat arbitrary, based on arbitrary things that we've gotten used to, like language and little knots of local culture. So in all honesty, I am a citizen of a world that has no boundaries. Well, of course, you and I know the world does have boundaries. Try crossing into Canada without a passport sometime if you don't believe me. You can't do it anymore. And the various languages and cultures of the world are quite different from each other at many counts. Different rituals, different customs, different traditions, and even different primary values divide us. It always feels a bit imperialistic and self-serving when people try to get me to agree that everyone on earth is basically the same and that cultural differences are cosmetic and easily transcended. This is a very serious distortion, I think, of humanistic thinking, a very serious distortion of what Diogenes said when he claimed to be cosmopolitan. No essential boundaries does not mean no basic differences. Now, many of you may not know that Unitarian Universalist congregations around the country are not all called First Church and Second Church and Third Church, but they have other names too. And one of the most common names that they have is All Souls. All Souls Church in Washington, D.C., for example. All Souls Church in Tulsa, Oklahoma. All Souls Church in New York City, on the island of Manhattan, where my friend Forrest Church was senior minister for 30 years before he died. Not First Church, not Second Church, not even Olympia Brown Congregation or Mariah Cook Church, but All Souls. It's probably the most common name for our congregations around the country. Now, the word refers to the universalist and Unitarian affirmation that all souls, all people, are important. All individuals are significant. No one gets to claim authority over anyone else's spiritual life. You get to do it yourself because you're important. The universalists put it this way theologically in the 19th century. All souls, they said, are embraced by a loving God both before and after death. As there is no hell after death, no fiery torment, so there should be no hell on earth caused by human malice. So let's all work together to make this world a better place where women and other minorities have a real voice, slavery is abolished, prisons are not torture chambers, and the mentally ill are considered people, not terrifying curiosities. And so during the 19th century, the Universalists went forth and worked on all of these issues. But saying that we regard all souls, no matter how different they are from each other, as fully human is not the same thing as knowing how to deal with those differences honestly and carefully, and without either righteousness or hubris. They really are two different things. Let me tell you a little story about when some Unitarian Universalists were facing their own words of affirmation about what they believed, and they were caught short in how they responded to how they believed. Not long ago, actually about 15 years ago, there was a congregation near Chicago that used to use neo-pagan rituals in their Sunday services. They wanted to join the Unitarian Universalist Association of Congregations, which requires a vote of the Board of Trustees of the Unitarian Universalist Association. They had gone through all of the institutional hoops they needed to go through, filled out all the paperwork, and so forth. And they passed all these with flying colors. However, some folks on the UUA board in those days wondered if neo-pagan rituals weren't just a bit too unlike more typical Unitarian Universalist services. Now, they didn't know much about neo-paganism, which is a form of religious practice which technically dates from the 1940s in England, but which claims a more ancient lineage. But some of the board members worried if we let the church into the UUA, the Unitarian Universalist Association, that it would give us a bad reputation when we went to the interfaith table. They worried it would be disturbing to the uninitiated and perceived as frivolous by the tough-as-nails crowd. So the vote came up. It turned out as the moderator went around asking yes or no to each board member, that the first two board members who were asked to vote voted no. We don't want them. Both of them, by chance, were members of congregations with the great name of All Souls. So when Irv Miller, the third vote, was asked yes or no by the moderator, he said, "Why, yes." And then he turned to his fellow board members who had just voted no, and he said, "Well, I guess you guys are going to have to change the name of your congregations to Some Souls." The two were mortified. The rest of the board laughed, and then everyone else voted yes. Now you understand the title of this sermon, but there's a lot more to understand than just the title.
Like, for example, the theme for this month, which is democracy. In his book, The Good Society, sociologist Robert Bella says that democracy begins with paying attention. But often attention is only the tip of the iceberg of what is actually needed. I chose the Anne Fadiman reading earlier because she tells a far more nuanced story than I can about how hard it can be to fashion a working society when two or more groups misunderstand each other so completely. Yet before I say more about the situation she writes about, let me tell you another story. After earning my bachelor's degree, I became a VISTA volunteer, working at a reading site of the Minnesota Literacy Council and helping train volunteers to be English as a second language tutors. It was during that year that I began to know the Southeast Asian communities in the Twin Cities. After that year, and before entering seminary, I worked as essentially the Anglo-Middle management of a small Cambodian immigrant and refugee social service agency in St. Paul. I wrote grants, managed educational and employment programs, and often helped translate what the funders wanted for the Cambodians themselves. The job was a better education than college ever was. But what I came away with was far from the mastery of any single subject matter. In fact, what I learned was the need for humility and how much attention, persistence, and plain trial and error can be necessary to create a fabric strong enough to encompass the stresses of our contemporary pluralistic society. Every time I thought I understood Cambodian culture, something would happen to make sure I knew just how much I had yet to learn. One unfortunate mishap happened as part of a program we had going in a single elementary school in St. Paul, where our organization and a group of teachers acted as a bridge between the school and the families of Cambodian students who went there. After presenting a workshop as part of their start-of-the-year in-service training, one of the teachers came up to me to thank me for the work that we were doing, the work that we were beginning. He was a Vietnam War veteran, and he was glad to have the opportunity to help heal some of the pain caused by the war. I couldn't have been more pleased, and in my enthusiasm, I told Chanta, who ran the program, about our exchange. Several days later, however, I learned that most of the Cambodian youth were not going to school. "Chanta," I asked, "what's going on?" "Well, I told them about the teacher," he said, "who fought in Vietnam. They remember a few years ago when a former soldier in Long Beach shot at Cambodian children when they were at school, and they're afraid." What had I done? This was jeopardizing our program and, more importantly, harming the education I was supposed to be helping the youth attain. The tragedy in Long Beach had happened before I started working with the Cambodians in St. Paul. While I had heard of it, to my mind it was as distant as could be from our situation. It was, of course, much closer to home for the Cambodian families. The veteran in Long Beach was troubled and suffered a psychic break. The veteran on staff at our school was not facing those demons, though he had done a great deal of work to settle himself back into society after the war. When we were able to introduce him to several trusted family members in the community, their fear dissipated, and they felt good enough to send their children back to school again. We fixed that one and emerged the stronger and a bit wiser for it. All souls, all residents, Cambodian and U.S. born alike.
Robert Bella, Eric said, thinks democracy begins when we pay attention. But pay attention to what? To the whole, he says, the whole. Not just to our local familiar circles, the ones we are used to. The phrase Dr. Appiah used in his reading. Because in order for democracy to work at all, we need to learn to have conversations across real boundaries and pay attention to what we are not used to. Pay attention to what we are not used to. If everyone in a democracy is to have a voice, we need to be able to actually hear that voice. And that means paying attention to what another culture might actually be saying. I have heard Unitarian Universalists throughout my career without much sense of our own history announcing to their friends that we have always been supportive of diverse cultures. Women have always been in the pulpit. We've always had gay and lesbian board members, transgender teachers, and maybe even the grandchild of a Hmong immigrant someplace in the Sunday school. I'm sorry, that's simply not true. The Universalist men in Mariah Cook's time did everything they could to keep her out of the pulpit, and many women were against what she was trying to do as well. They simply were not used to women doing such things. And later, Unitarians were used to what we now call straight people only in their pulpits and in their classrooms. And they constantly bragged about their church being filled with like-minded people, meaning people who looked a lot like them, shared politics, and had Northern European Protestant heritage. But being truly democratic, inviting a diversity of voices to join us in progressive religion, is not some intellectual decision that we make by saying, this is what we should be doing. Now that we've decided it, we're done. That's simply not true. It's a lot of hard work crossing those boundaries. It's paying attention to our own comfortable boundaries, people just like us, and then willfully and deliberately crossing them, even if it feels uncomfortable at first and even if we make plenty of mistakes. It's holding ourselves accountable to others, not just to ourselves. It's allowing ourselves truly with Diogenes to imagine being citizens of the world. Hard to do? You got it. But as Dr. Appiah affirms, and I agree, it's entirely, entirely worthwhile.
Becoming more fully democratic will be hard, and it will be worthwhile, and there will also never be a perfect way forward. There is a memorable account in Anne Fadiman's story of the young girl with epilepsy. She observes a public health nurse visiting the Lee family in their home. The nurse is trying to teach Leah's mother how to check the girl's heart rate by placing her finger on the girl's neck and by following the second hand, counting the number of heartbeats in a minute. Only the woman can't tell time, and she doesn't have a watch. The nurse, who so completely missed the mark there in one small example, later provides a key image to describe the loss that takes place when those of different cultures fail to understand one another. It was as if, he told Fadiman, by a process of reverse alchemy, each party in this relationship had managed to convert each other's gold into dross. To convert each other's gold into dross. Dross, the old English word for dregs. Instead of the hoped-for science of taking something base and turning it into gold, when we don't make the effort to reach beyond what we have become used to, we end up doing just the opposite. We take what could have been priceless and squander it. Coming together across cultures is never easy. To make that kind of gold often takes years, if not generations. If I had remained working with the Cambodians, I would have learned a few more things about them. And they are learning, with moments of grace as well as occasional fits and starts, to learn what it can be to be both Cambodian and American. My experience has been in part with Southeast Asian refugees. Now we are learning to live here with Somalis, and the cycle doesn't stop there. Already we're hearing reports of Iraqi immigrants, families of those who risk so much to provide our forces reliable interpretation and cultural guidance, returning back home because they just couldn't get past the struggles they've encountered here. What a loss for us. What a loss for them. I've been talking about refugees because I know a bit about them, and their issues bring a clear light to our discussion today. All souls. What we are used to is only the starting point. Becoming more deeply democratic means reaching beyond the comfortable and listening to the unfamiliar voices of those who live beside us. Is that where the promise of gold lies for us? Is that the art of alchemy in our age? I think so. We are better off when we remember that the smart woman who has not yet learned to tell time is the same woman who makes some of the most beautiful needlework in the world. As far as I'm concerned, those moments of realization and appreciation are worth more than gold because they enlarge my understanding of what it means to be human and of what we can become together. All souls, each and every one of us, that's the promise of democracy.